Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, May 30th already. I'm Ray Graff. Today we talk astronomy and we welcome back Bob Berman at Valerie Rapson to talk about that subject. So if you have a question about the heavens, the universe, maybe what's beyond it, well, here's a hint. There's nothing beyond it. Give us a call, 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You can also email your astronomy questions to voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. That's the email. And the number is 800-348-2551. Always love talking astronomy. Always great to have Bob and Valerie back in the studio. And we will get to your calls and many other things coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers in the studio today, twice as many brains. We have Bob Berman, who is one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world. He's the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. And, you know, she's done for the semester, so she's pretty relaxed. If you have an astronomy question, give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Hello, Valerie Rapson. How are you?
Oh, doing so good. As you said, it's officially summer. Maybe not astronomically, but at least from the college's calendar, it's summer.
And so you said, as I came in, you and Bob were talking about a project you're working on to photograph the moon, and you're going to try it in daylight.
Yeah. We've got the 1 meter telescope up at the college camp at Oneonta.
That's a biggie, right?
Yeah. And we haven't actually taken any pictures through it yet. So tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up. I'm going to go outside in the morning, do some testing. And then if everything goes well, my students this summer can start to take some pictures at night of cool things.
Exciting. Bob, what's happening with you?
Well, the biggest thing is getting the pool open, warming it to the 88 degrees that I keep it all summer. This morning, the LP gas company came and I saw what keeping a pool, a huge pool, because it's a big pool, because I like to do laps, what it really means financially to keep a pool that warm when they had to fill up this giant tank. And I realized, well, there's a consequence of that. So, but that's probably the extent of the whining that I should do at this point.
That sounds like a first world problem to me. Valerie, did you know that astronomy could be so lucrative?
Oh, no, I guess not. This is great.
Something to shoot for down the road.
Yeah.
Maybe you two will have an enormous pool.
Yeah.
Why 88 degrees?
Because when you get into it, within 10 seconds, you're used to it. You're used to the water. You don't have to say, oh, you know, come on in. You'll get used to it. You know when people say that, you'll get used to it, or things like that. Those are euphemisms for it's cold.
All right. Well, sometimes it's nice. I like to swim up in Maine. You know why? Because you get used to it. It's bracing. It's good. All right. We're off topic here. Hey, I saw, you know, this is big news. The auroras is... It's huge news this year, and apparently, according to the Associated Press, it'll be back in our skies in June.
It's true, and at the Farmer's Almanac, we're just getting flooded with calls for information. In early May, we had the greatest solar storm in 20 years, and it was caused by a huge sunspot area. A big geomagnetic area like that can cause flares, and it did produce X-type flares, which actually radiates stuff in all directions, like sprays it, and it can cause coronal mass ejections, which aim stuff directly, like in one direction. And if you see photos of the moon, of the sun, and the sunspot is not in the center, but a little to the right of center, that's the position where if there's a CME, coronal mass ejection, that's where it can aim it at us. And those things actually happen, and of course we had great auroras. Well, usually there's a 27-day rotation period for the sun, at least in those latitudes of the sun, and most of them don't survive a complete rotation. They fade out. This one survived because it's just reappeared on the edge of the sun, and we're starting to see it. It's changed its name. Its name was AR 13664, And now that we're seeing it afresh, for some reason, it has a new name. I want everyone to memorize this. It's AR-13697. So it's already producing X-class flare. So it's there. It's active. But on June 4th and 5th, it'll be in that position again where if there's a coronal mass ejection, it'll aim it at us. And we can get some amazing auroras just like we did a month ago.
Now, Valerie, did you get a look at them last month?
No, and I'm so sad I missed them because I was visiting family down in Savannah, Georgia, and I really didn't know it was happening until I started to get text messages from everybody up here that was like, hey, are you out taking pictures? Look at these aurora. And I was like, I went south, like the worst 2 days to go south.
Well,
so I did not get to see them.
I have a worse one than that. So we're very excited about these things. Mm-hmm. I keep telling my kids, oh, you got to see this at least once. This is your chance.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a little cloudy as the sun went down on the big night. And of course, you know, my wife and I, we hit the sack by 9:30 most of the time. Went to bed. Next day at work, everybody said, oh gosh, it was amazing, even in, you know, Albany and in suburbs.
Right.
So maybe this time.
But for people who missed it, here's the consolation thing that you have to remember. To the eye, just to the eye, it was pale.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a faint trace of red, which is very unusual because the eye cannot detect red at low light levels. But this was bright enough red so that we saw a faint red. But you didn't really see what we get to see when we lead groups to Alaska, for example. It was faint, faint bands, faint vertical lines. But with cameras, even a cell phone camera, you point it up there and all of a sudden now you've got the colors. So those photos that everyone has been seeing and showing to their friends and people who said, oh, I miss it. Well, you would not have seen that, what you've seen in the photos. Mm-hmm. I promise you. The image through a camera is different from what you actually see.
This is interesting. Now, if I, there are many times I'll go out and we'll look north and we'll say, geez, is that, you know, we haven't been out long enough for the rods in our eyes to sort of get used to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm never sure. And I said, gosh, is that, could it be, you know, if I put a camera, if I put my phone up, will I be able to get some evidence?
Yes. Yes.
Interesting.
And right. And that's a very quick way to tell if it's an aurora. You'll see within seconds, if you see a red or a green glow there, it shows it's an aurora because light pollution is generally a pale amber from the sodium vapor lamps that are now prevalent.
Mm-hmm. And make sure you take a few second exposure if you can. Most of our phones now can, you know, expose for 3 to 5 seconds at least, and that's really going to be the best way to see it.
I'm going to have to figure out how to do that. I'm not too technical.
Just ask your kids. They'll
show you. Exactly. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman join us today. It's Astronomy. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Let's grab a couple emails before the first break, and then we'll go to the phones. This one's from Harleen. Is the universe finite? Jan 11 discusses this issue. Can you explain the topology of the universe? Valerie, you go first.
Yeah, well, we definitely know that the universe is flat from many studies. I mean, we can look at things like the cosmic microwave background and how it's mostly even with small non-uniformities, and it mixes just right with all of our models that say, you know, everything is smooth and flat. Basically, you know, the universe has been expanding and it's flattened out over time. So we know that that's the basic structure. Of course, on large scales, I'm not saying, you know, locally nearby things are flat. We're talking whole universe size.
Yeah.
Things are relatively flat. And we still, you know, we don't have a great sense of finite versus infinite for our universe. I mean, we have a finite observable universe. We can only see out so far. But exactly what's beyond that, we can never directly observe it. So it's hard to really tell.
Bob.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And cosmologists are divided as to what the universe is like at that 13.8 billion light-year distance at which objects are receding at the speed of light, and we can't see anything beyond that. The thing is, if you can't see anything beyond that, you don't know what's beyond that. Logic tells us that the same types of galaxies and stars would continue. Why should they be any different? But does it continue forever? In other words, is it infinite, as our caller is asking, or does it stop somewhere? And we know the old problem with it stopping somewhere. Well, then we'd imagine what's beyond that. We can't imagine it stopping somewhere, but the human mind cannot visualize infinity either. So we have to be honest or humble enough to admit that this is something that's beyond the logic system to really grasp. But we can say there is, as Valerie said, a separation between the observable or visible universe. Now, that is finite, because we know where that ends. And then what's beyond that and how far it goes and whether it's just simply big or whether it has to be big. Otherwise, we wouldn't have this flat topology locally that we see. But is it infinitely big? Many believe it is. And perhaps aesthetically or philosophically, perhaps it is. But make sense of it? Well, good luck.
Well, I mean, that's why you're here. So hopefully you'll give it a shot, yeah?
Someday. We try. We try. Right. We do our best.
Larry writes in, Big Bang, question mark. Big Bang or Big Bounce? What do you think, Bob?
Well, to be a bounce, the suggestion is that we're reverberating from a previous universe. We're left with sometimes Neil deGrasse Tyson writes that the one thing about science that you can is that you can count on it. You can be sure of it. Yet if you said to him, well, what about spontaneous generation? Do you believe in that? He'd say, oh, come on. That was centuries ago. We believe that after a rain, suddenly you start seeing like little creatures, slugs and snails. And they believed back then, well, given the right conditions, these things just pop into existence. It was called spontaneous generation. And science, and all of us, I'm sure, here in the room and all of our listeners say, that's ridiculous. We don't believe in that. Yet, science does believe in a Big Bang, where supposedly the universe spontaneously popped out of nothingness one Saturday morning for reasons that no one can understand. And so we actually do believe in spontaneous generation in a very real sense, in that we believe the universe popped out of nothingness spontaneously. But was that the result of a, since we can't know what happened before, was that the result of a previous collapse, in which case it was a bounce from something else? No one can know.
Right. It's all going to boil down to the evidence that we have. And right now, we don't have super strong evidence one way or the other. We have a bunch of models that say, oh, this is what the universe would like look like in these different scenarios. And we seem to live in this point where all those models kind of merge together.
Yeah.
And the more we can look back with like our big telescopes like James Webb, the more we can see where the models deviate in time and space and try and, you know, pick. Are we in this reverberating universe? Are we in just an instant universe that's going to expand forever? Will it stop? You know, will it rip? These are all the questions.
Rip. How's it going to rip?
We don't know. I mean, I don't even know what it really means for space-time to rip. But theoretically, you could move so fast that whatever's holding the fabric of space-time together can't anymore. So,
yikes.
I don't know. I hope I never experience
that.
That's
another thing for me to worry about. Let's take a break. I'll just add that to the list. Valerie Rapson is here. Bob Berman is here. It's Astronomy. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Fox Pop, and it's Astronomy Today. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here, and Valerie Rapson is here. And just a reminder, up next, we will air a live candidate forum in the race for the New York State Assembly's 109th district seat. It's being hosted by WAMC and the New York League of Conservation Voters Education Fund right over at the Linda, across the street from the studio here. That's WAMC's Performing Arts Studio. You can hear it live on the radio coming up after this program. By the way, a little more housekeeping. The fund drive starts a week from Monday. That's June 10th. And we'll be on the air raising money for this radio station. The lockbox is open right now, though. And, you know, times could be a little tough for public radio right now. There are big stations laying off vast quantities of workers. And it's a shame. But that's the way sort of the media thing goes. It goes in cycles. Luckily, we have not done that. We have not done that in my memory, and I've been here a long time. And that's really because you at home and you members of the station have always stepped up, and we're going to ask you to do it again. The lockbox is open. You can make a pledge at wamc.org right now if you want to, while you're listening to this program, and their premiums and everything else. Every dollar we raise now is going to help shorten the on-air drive, which begins June 10th, WAMC.org. All right, with that said, let's go to the phones, and we'll begin in Connecticut. Jim, you're on. Oh, in Simsbury, Connecticut. Hello. That's you, man.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, barely. Are you on the moon?
No, is this better?
Yes, it is.
Okay, two things. One is, how could a three-dimensional object like the universe be flat? Or does that just mean it's not a saddle and it's not a sphere? Second thing is, dear Mr. Berman, please don't waste natural, please don't waste fossil fuels. You're swimming comfortably, that you get used to. If you jump in and it's cold, won't hurt you a bit. Some people even do it, and it'll save some fuel and some air.
All right, man. So let's go to your first question there, and go ahead, Valerie.
Yeah, so I can tackle this one. You're exactly right. When we talk about flat universe, we're saying it's not a sphere, it's not saddle shaped. These are other mathematical options that we can get to. But kind of a neat way to think about this is if you think about, like power lines. We all see those, and they look like they're two-dimensional. They look like they're flat. They move across the sky or in between the poles. But if you get close enough, if you zoom in, you realize they are three-dimensional, just on much smaller scales. So that's really what we mean when we say the universe is flat, is if you could somehow move out, zoom out, and look at the whole universe, it would look flat and thin. But when you get in close enough, you can see all of the three-dimensional objects that are buried inside of it.
Makes sense, Jim. All right. Hey, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. To me, that seems a little odd because, one, you can't get outside to take that picture
right,
and get that look. To us, it looks like it's filled with stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we have to use our observations from being buried inside to see that it actually is flat.
But are we imagining that?
I hope not. The math says we're not. So okay. I'm going to trust the math on this
one. Well, you have a PhD, so I'm going to go with you on this. Let's go to Woodstock. Roy, how you doing, buddy?
Ray Ski.
How you doing,
man? I'm good. I'm good. I really want to ask you a stereo question, but I'll put that off for another time.
Yeah, shoot me an email.
What I'm wondering, Bob, is, and I think about it all the time, partly because I've been a photographer since the Big Bang happened, and I drive around, and every day, every night, that is, around Woodstock, there are more and more outdoor lights, LEDs, that are keeping us from seeing the skies. And I know our children and their kids will see nothing in a few years. What would it take for us to make a town like Woodstock night sky friendly, like they have done in other places around the country?
Well, you're right. We need zoning ordinances, local ordinances that do things like motion-controlled lighting. Now, that's an easy solution. If you're concerned about security around your house, have a light that comes on for a minute or two and lights your way into your door and then goes off. And that's a good way not to to have bright lights. And I believe Woodstock has some sort of ordinance, but we need more and more local ordinances mm-hmm. like that to keep the sky dark. And I'm totally on your side with that.
Yeah. Valerie.
And it's always good to, try and get as many people around you to also care. Because, I've lived in a lot of towns that have these ordinances, but as soon as a big box store comes in, they apply for a waiver and, the lights go up and there's not much we can do about it. So having the friends and the advocacy that can really push and go to those town hall meetings and say, no, we actually do care about keeping the lights down and following through with these rules is also really important.
Right.
And they make red lights in some of these places. Like, I know there's places in Florida or a town where people go to look at the sky, and all of the community's lights at night are red.
Oh, I've been in those districts myself. Yes, there you go. It's a lot of red lights. Try Amsterdam if you want to.
You want to really see stars.
Hey, now.
Yeah, well, I would love to see that happen in my town. And
yeah.
I don't know, it's probably a losing battle, but.
Not for nothing, Roy. The sun could take care of this for you. These X flares could EMP us right into having some dark skies. But then you won't be able to hear this radio show. Mm-hmm. And there you go. Hey, man, thanks for the call, and shoot me an email on the stereo question. 800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is here. Valerie Rapson is here. If we have an EMP at some point, whether it's an adversary doing it or whether it's the sun, like in, what, 1880, whatever the Carrington event happened.
1859.
Right. So will the circuitry come back, or is it immediately fried forever? This is the question I have.
Well, there was a government, big, expensive government study of this that
Starfish
showed
Prime.
that there'd be up to $2 trillion of damage, permanent damage to our infrastructure if there was a Carrington-type event, that hugest of all flares, solar flares in 1859, happened again in 1921, by the way. And
really?
And that one set fire to the New York Central Railway on Park Avenue and 59th Street. And so they can happen, but they're rare enough that few people are scared about it. And
but the next time it happens, and it presumably will happen, I mean, 1921, whatever electronics they had was tubes, and they're much more hardy toward that. But there's a lot of stuff that could get zapped, a lot of ICs and everything else that could no longer function, right?
True, and satellites.
And satellites as well.
And stuff like that.
All right.
And, you know, I'm still sitting here thinking about that caller who's criticizing my 88-degree pool. So I'm going to spend 5 seconds saying that I also have solar panels to help the environment, huge solar panels, so I don't need outside electricity. And I have electric cars. And so I'm doing my share. And if I'm allowing myself a warm swimming pool, well, that's the one area that you should try it sometime and see how nice that feels.
All right. Okay. Well, let's go to the next call then. 800-348-2551. Let's go to Argyle and our friend Merle. Hello, Merle. And Merle, hello.
Hello.
Merle. Hey, buddy, you there? Merle's not there. Hopefully Merle called back, Zach. We'll try to get Merle back on the air. Let's go to Chris and Housatonic. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, Valerie, I got 3 questions for you. Are satellites better than reconnaissance planes? And I saw an article the other day that another reconnaissance plane is going to go faster than the Blackbird. And lastly, are there aliens in the Bermuda Triangle?
Okay.
Nice. This is a whole array of questions.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have to think about, you know, what you're trying to do. Reconnaissance planes, you know, they have a purpose, but satellites are able to independently orbit. You know, nobody's got to fly them or anything like that. And they can be placed, they can be monitored, and they can be spread out across the Earth. So satellites definitely, you know, they champion over many of the other types of aviation that we can do for the purposes that we need them. And, you know, I've said on this show before, I'm very pro-alien, but I don't necessarily believe that they have arrived, that they're hanging out on Earth or anything like that. But I think that it wouldn't surprise me if someday we find them elsewhere in the universe. But I have no evidence that they are here, and I'm not sure that we're going to find them in the Bermuda Triangle.
The reason that I asked that, Valerie, is because I saw on one of my clips on my cell phone that the SR-71 was as much more technical than the satellites. And here's a theory for you, that the SR can take a pitch of the Earth of 100,000 square miles better than the satellite.
So that may be true. Yeah, if you've got, you know, high altitude planes that are photographing the ground, that distance does make a difference.
Yeah.
And if you can put modern equipment on it, sure. But most of our satellites serve other types of purposes.
Well, Chris, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. Valerie Rapson is here. Bob Berman is here. This show's about astronomy. So let's do somebody else that maybe got an astronomy question. Bob, you on?
Yeah, how you doing? I had a question for you.
Sure. Go ahead.
My wife tells me the sky is blue because we have so much water on the earth that the sun is reflecting off the ocean and it makes our sky blue. I was wondering if that was true or not.
Got a reverse there.
No. Shall I take this one?
Absolutely.
The real reason is that the sun, as we know, gives off all the colors of the spectrum. We see it in a rainbow. We see that in a bit of cut glass or prism we might have on our windowsill. And all those colors, the human eye is architecturally designed to see it as white. So we see the sunlight as essentially being white.
Okay, hang on. There we go. We're having a little feedback.
But of those different wavelengths, they vibrate at different rates. And it just so happens that air molecules are of just the right size to scatter or bounce around the shortest wavelengths, which are violet and blue. And so these are the ones, I could give you a figure. Blue scatters 6 times more than red light. So it dominates the sky. But if you have a portable spectroscope, as I hope you do, drag it out from the drawer, from wherever you keep it, look at the sky with it, and you'll see all the colors coming from the sky. I was surprised the first time I did this that the sky actually is reflecting all of the sun's wavelengths, but it's reflecting 6 times more blue than red. So blue is the dominant color that we see.
Okay, there we go. Number here is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. Tell you what, before the next break, let's grab a few emails here, and then we'll go back to the phones at the other side of the break. Jay writes in, subject heading, unifying theory. What is still missing from the unifying theory? Will it ever explain how the universe was formed definitively?
Well, there's quite a bit that we still don't understand. I mean, we were talking the Big Bang earlier and exactly how it happened, how things existed before we defined the start of time and what created the Big Bang as part of it. And then a lot of unification is taking things on the large scale, the astronomical scale that we often talk about, and linking them to the quantum, the very small scale, and making sure that the math can carry us through from the small to the average to the very large. And those are the pieces that are missing. I know, Bob, you always quote, I forget the number. There's like a scale difference, 10 to the, I don't know, 90-something. Do you remember that number where there's like, you know, the difference between the quantum and the astronomical world? You know what I'm talking about?
But the main thing is that you just said it when you said we don't exactly know how it, and that's how it's often phrased on TV too. We don't exactly know. The truth is, it's not that we don't exactly know. It's that we have no idea how the universe could have popped out of nothingness. And if somebody has an idea on the radio, how you get, I mean, look around you. There's a lot of stuff here in the universe, a lot of stars and galaxies. How do you get this from nothing? And that's what astrophysicists, that's what theorists are saying, that it really came from nothing. Mm-hmm. Some of us for a while were saying, well, but there was something right before, and then going, no. We're talking about day zero, moment zero, that it really popped out of nothingness. And so some say, well, what about there were membranes of a certain sort, energy membranes that collided, and that's called the brain theory. But that's still something.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, you know, if they already existed, how can time have started at the Big Bang? And, you know, there's all of these other questions that come up, right? Like, we have to have something. Where did it come from?
Yeah.
It was really small, and then how did it develop into something large with different properties and different types of physics that govern it on those scales?
Yeah. And while we're on the topic of different properties, and we've talked about this before, you know what? I can understand very little of what you two say because I'm a radio guy. But as I understand it, the quantum world operates with certain different rules than the big world, the big universe. Does that strike you, eminently smart people, as odd? In other words, shouldn't the rules be the same? Why are the rules different? Well, and at what point do those rules change?
Right.
How big do things have to be before those rules switch?
So the idea is, if you have this unified theory, it governs everything. And you can make small tweaks to the math and say, okay, well, if I'm on the large scale, this happens, and then I make some small tweaks to the same mathematical physics and theory because it's all governing everything, and then I get out stuff at the human Earth scale. And then I can make another small tweak to it, and I can settle down into the quantum world. But there's still one description, one scientific theory that describes it all. You're just making small changes and kind of boiling it down to this. It's like taking Einstein to Newton or Newton to Einstein. You're just going up to different scales, changing the math ever so slightly, and now you can describe so much more accurately.
But isn't that changing the rules of the game if you're changing the math even slightly?
Well, exactly. And Einstein, as I think everybody knows, after his 1905 special relativity theory, his 1915 general relativity theory, the rest of his life, he didn't die until the mid-1950s,
yeah,
was devoted to trying to find what Valerie is quite properly calling a theory of everything, mm-hmm, that could combine quantum with the let's call classical science, as it's called, and make everything work. There was a while, about 50, 60 years ago, especially in the 60s when it really started, when string theory started to make claims that it could be the theory of everything, that they were essentially one-dimensional vibrating threads that, depending upon how they vibrated, whether they looped together, whether they came together, could explain the four forces, because there are four fundamental forces that govern all the interactions we see in the universe, and could explain quantum gravity, which nobody's been able to explain. And so we had high hopes for string theory. The reason you don't hear anything about it these days is that it didn't work. The math couldn't work without imagining seven extra dimensions, or 11 in total, for which there's no evidence for any additional dimensions. And the one way it could be tested failed by 10 to the 50th power. So having no way to support it, and having required extra dimensions that there's no evidence for, it's just quietly faded. It was hopeful because these guys are brilliant who came up with it. Mm-hmm. But many ideas in science look exciting at first and then they don't pan out. And
wow,
this looks like one of them.
But do you want to buy my copy of Hyperspace? Because it's one of my favorite. Let's take a break here. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, astronomy. That was only one email. We'll do a few more, and then we'll hit the phones once again. Bop for you there on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here, and Bob Berman here as well to answer your astronomy questions. And let's grab a few more emails. We answered that one. It took a long time. And we'll do two or three more, and then we'll go back to the phones. And I see Merle is holding. So obviously we'll have to get to Merle as soon as we can. This one's from Dawn. Can you recommend where in the sky we can look for the aurora? How much above the horizon? Do we need to be out in the country? Do we need clear skies? Is there a website that will carry live-time coverage? And that is from Dawn.
Yes, the best website is the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. They put out a website called Aurora Forecast. Use that. That's probably the best and most accurate one. Auroras vary so much that you can't make one statement about them. But the most common place to look is not the north, but west of north, because they form a glowing donut surrounding the magnetic North Pole for our area, and the magnetic North Pole isn't north but northwest from here. So look to the northwest, look maybe halfway up the sky, and if you don't have a bright glow because your neighbor's throwing a party, or if there's not a big city up in that direction,
yeah,
and you're not used to having a glow there, you may see the beginning of it. And then check every 15 minutes, every half hour, see if there's straight lines, arcs, blotches, takes many different forms. Rare for us to see curtains here.
Oh, I saw that once. Mm.
But
spectacular.
Wow.
Yeah.
Spectacular.
Yeah. Oh,
yes.
My God.
I want to toss out spaceweather.com, too.
Space weather?
You can get text messages and emails for aurora alerts directly, ooh, from then. So that's how I knew what I was missing.
I got to do that. Yes. Now, assuming that we get some in the early June days, Valerie, will you be out there at the university?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We'll be there. As long as it's clear, right? We have to cross our fingers that this happens also on a night that it is clear. We were very lucky that that's what it was like in May, but we could have a total clouded out night and be missing all of the beauty up
but,
there.
You know, when I went to bed, it was still partly cloudy. True. And I said, hey, you know what? It's not going to be that nice.
Right.
You got to stick it out. You got
to hold it. The caller also asked about cities, whether you need to be outside of cities. The answer is yes.
If you
want dark skies.
Yeah. All right. Kay writes in, subject heading, I'm relatively confused. Well, Kay, I join you in
Welcome
that.
Welcome to the club.
This is so perplexing to me, writes Kay, that I don't even know how to formulate the question, but I'll give it a go. So let's say there are two bodies in space. One is moving at the speed of light. Mm-hmm. One is stationary. Both have a window by which they can see the other. Body 1, moving at the speed of light, passes body 2, stationary. I think that in this scenario, it would be impossible for either body observing the other to determine which is moving and which is stationary. So, if that is the case, and understanding that time would move slower for the body in motion, or at least as perceived from either perspective, how can it be that time would pass quicker or slower for either? And I say, Kay, check, please, because you confused me. All right, go ahead, astronomers.
I got this. She actually described relativity perfectly because everything is relative. And she's right. She's getting at the idea that moving clocks run slow. If you are watching somebody else move at the speed of light, then that clock is going to run slow. But it's all perspective. The person who actually, if we can assume that one person actually is moving faster, their clock ticks at a normal rate. And it looks like the person outside who we've said isn't moving, it looks to the other person that they are actually moving at the speed of light, and their clock will tick differently. So it matters who you are in the situation and what you perceive. There isn't one right answer of whose clock is running fast or slow. It changes depending on who you are.
This dovetails, and I want to get back to the emails. There was an article, I think it's from today, on the CNN website, why scientists say we need to send clocks to the moon and soon. And this ties in really with what you were just talking about.
Yeah.
They want to, I guess it's what, 56 microseconds shorter day.
Yeah, because the clocks run a little bit faster because the gravity is less on the moon. So this is, relativity describes all of this.
Right.
So I think ultimately what we're going to have to do is define like an Earth second and a moon second and have some calibration between them, because you can't tick a second at the same rate on both locations. And this is true for satellites. Like, we know how to adjust for this, but we have never really cared or thought about it deeply for the moon. But now that we're going to send people there, they need to have accurate clocks and they need to be able to calibrate what they perceive as time compared to what the Earth perceives as time.
But we went to the moon. We had guys walking around on the moon.
Sure.
It was fine.
Just for a couple of days. And, you know, if your clocks were mismatched by a few microseconds, nobody cared. But if you're going to live there for years on end, it's ultimately going to add up and you'll be, you know, days or months different at some point.
Bob?
Well, an old question. Because not too long ago, it was just fine to use Earth's spin. And if you had a telescope that used some very distant object like a quasar, when your crosshairs came back to pointing at that quasar again and you knew Earth had spun once, which, by the way, takes 86,400 seconds, you knew that a day had passed and that was your time. 86,400 seconds is one day. But because Earth slows down, over time, very slowly, you know, we only lose a second in something like 70 centuries. We needed more accurate time. And so people who are into this, and I know some listeners probably are, know that time is now defined by using the cesium-133 atom. Very easy. We spray up cesium-133 atoms, and there are two states that it can be in. It particularly affects the nucleus, and those are called the hyperfine states. And it'll only be in one state if it gets hit with microwaves of exactly the frequency of 9,192,631,770. So we now define time.
70 what?
Cycles of that cesium-133 atom or microwave frequencies.
Okay,
that
so this is
going to cause Hertz? This hyperfine
mm-hmm.
level.
Okay.
Yeah, in Earthly laboratories and at the National Institute of Standards and Technology that were kind enough to actually asked me to do a lecture for them some years back, and then I was given a tour of the atomic clocks there and could see how it works. It's marvelous because it's accurate now to that, to one part in 9,192,631,770 parts per second. And no one has to monitor this, because if the if it differs, if you lose that hyperfine state, a servo mechanism will change the frequency until it's back to that same hyperfine state. So it maintains that many frequencies as defining a second. So that's how a second is defined, and I don't see why that couldn't be used on the moon as well.
Mm-hmm. My head hurts. All right, let's go to the next question. This one's from Jim. Infinity is the subject heading. Jim writes, some hippy-dippy speculation on infinity. Yeah, it's hard to imagine a wall we can't step beyond, but if the universe is infinite, does that not imply that information density is infinite at every point, i.e., it's the white light the mystics talk about at every point, and there'd be no differences. Everything would be white light. So, in order for differences to be perceived, the universe has to seem finite. And that's from Jim. I need therapy after this program.
My brain's starting to explode.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a rough show, man.
This is one of those.
These are cool ideas.
Lava lamp shows we used to do in the old days.
Well, infinity introduces so many paradoxes and so many problems that you don't really want to deal with it. Not only can't you picture infinity, nobody can, but if you believe in an infinite universe, for example, that the that there are infinite numbers of universes. That not only just means that there are infinite differences from one to the other, but it would also mean that there'd be infinite rays, infinite copies, and infinite Valeries in that, because infinite, there's no limit. So you'd not only get variations that are without limit, but you'd also get identicalities, if that's a word, that would be without limit. Everything would be without limit. And if the topic isn't mind-stretching enough, just when you barely touch it, the more you get into it, the more it's something you don't want to go near.
Oh, no, I want a few more of me. I'll take some days off. I mean, that's what I'm looking
for. I feel like there's a movie about this somewhere.
Oh, there has to be. And then, so we're on definitely a wacky bent here on this show today. Nate writes in with a question for Valerie.
Uh-oh.
Do you believe in different multiverses?
Oh, believe is such a strong word. There's no proof for it, and I think it'd be really cool, but somebody's got to show me like a white hole where, you know, we've got information coming in from another universe that I can see before I'll truly say that I believe it. But it is one of the possibilities, and I like to keep an open mind about everything until we have definitive proof otherwise. Because you never know. I mean, it'd be really cool.
Last email, and then we have to go to the phones again. This is another Jim. Oh, boy. Hey, there's supposed to be a mirror universe. That's a new one. Okay, there's a problem with antiparticles. Why aren't there an equal number of antiparticles? Should have been created at the Big Bang, and therefore the universe should cancel out. But Feynman said antiparticles look like regular particles going backward in time. So, obvious Big Bang answer, there is a mirror universe going backwards in time, starting at the Big Bang, made mostly of antiparticles, and that's from Jim.
Well, you know, backwards in time was an idea that's pretty much been abandoned also, because Einstein made it clear that you can't separate time from space-time. They are part of a single matrix, and that time... There's very few physicists, in fact, none that I presently know, who believe that time is an actual thing. Mm-hmm. And that is a big issue. And it used to be debated. Isaac Newton believed that time is a real thing, a matrix sort of, that everything moves through and ages. It's why we age, et cetera. And other brilliant people like Immanuel Kant said, no, it's an idea in our minds. It's the way we keep track of change. It's like our numbering system on clocks. Time is like that. It's something that we do with our minds. So if there is no time except as something that we do to sort of keep track of changes, then that even changes issues like this.
Mm-hmm. Valerie, last word on that?
I don't know.
All right, let's go back
to the
phones. You know what? Merle will straighten all this out. Merle and Argyle, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm glad to be back.
All right.
Cell phone, my little track phone died or
gotcha.
Something.
Go ahead.
All right. it has to do with looking at the moon. Just a couple of days ago, I saw the moon in the early morning. The dimple, what I call it, is probably a big crater at about 2 o'clock on the face of the moon.
Okay.
And that has been prominent up until 2 days ago when I saw the moon in the morning. And the dimple is now cut in half. What's happening?
Uh-oh.
Do you mean a crater or do you mean a dark round spot?
Yeah. That dark round spot around 2 o'clock.
That's Mare Crisium. That's one of the Mares or Maria, if that's the plural of it, or solidified
it's
lava areas
bulk.
On the moon. That's a naked eye object. I assume you're talking about seeing it and not using a telescope.
Not using a telescope.
Yeah, that is definitely Mare Crisium, the Sea of Crises. That's at the 2 o'clock position, and it's always in the same spot on the moon.
Okay.
But how come it's cut in half? Normally, I can see the whole thing.
Yeah, it probably has something to do with the phase changing. We're headed towards new moon now, so you're going to see less of that region illuminated. So I think you're just losing the light from that spot. And, come back next month around this time, and you'll be able to see it again.
Well, thanks for checking in. You know, I love looking at the moon in a beautiful blue daylight sky like today. And you see, it looks to me like a half moon, but that's really a quarter moon, right?
Mm-hmm. Two names for the same thing.
But why would a full moon be a circle and a half moon be a quarter moon?
Right. It's just choice of terminology, right? I mean, really, we're seeing, when we see the full moon, we're seeing a half moon. But it looks like a full circle to us.
Yes.
And then when we're thinking about the quarter moon, because that's really what's illuminated to us as one quarter, it looks like half a moon. So just choice.
Okay. I think the name quarter moon comes from the fact that it's a quarter of the way around. It's like a baseball diamonds, first base, second base, third base, and home.
Okay.
The phases are each 1 week apart from a complete lunation. So there's one quarter of the way around from new moon to new moon. You get the first quarter, then you get the half, the full moon, then you get the last quarter, because they're a quarter of the way around the cycle.
That makes sense.
All right, we have 2 minutes left. I want to get to Gene in Ware, Massachusetts, and then a very funny relativity question from Jerry. But let's go to Gene right now. And Gene, let's make it quick, my friend.
Yes, good afternoon, Valerie, Bob. Hi, Infinite Ray. my question has to do with the Big Bang Theory. And the fact that this infinitesimally small singularity makes almost no sense to everybody.
Uh-huh.
And also, given the fact that, as we were just talking about infinity, why wouldn't there have been the Big Bang in what we would consider a monstrous size that would, of course, get lost within an infinity? Has nobody ever thought of it wasn't a tiny, tiny, tiny little speck. It was a really big speck, but in a very, very big place.
Okay.
Right. Well,
your answer.
Yeah, well, the trouble is it's not a bad idea, but the pictures and the evidence that we have say otherwise. It says that, basically because the entire universe is about the same temperature, it must have been much closer and communicated that temperature and then cooled at the same rate as it expanded to make what we see in the sky today. So when we look at the CMB from the early universe, we're seeing even temperatures throughout. And the only way that can be is if the universe was much smaller, and if you run back in time and you shrink, naturally, we would say, we're just going to keep shrinking down to that infinitesimally small point.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. All right. Now, I'll try to read this question quickly, and then you can answer. The theme will be rolling. This is from Jerry. I live in central New York. My twin brother lives in Denver. According to relativity, gravity is stronger at my altitude, 850 feet. Time moves a tiny bit slower for me than my brother living at 5,000 feet. But due to the Earth's rotation, my brother at a greater distance from the Earth's axis is moving faster than I am, and time should be passing slightly slower for him at that higher speed. As a matter of pride, which twin is aging faster?
Oh, I need a pen and pencil to do out the map, but we could figure this out.
Really?
You send me the numbers.
I've done it.
Let's do it. Email those numbers.
No,
and the next
I've already
show
done
it
for an article in the Discover magazine.
Okay.
They balance out at a height of 2,000 miles.
Oh.
That's how high you'd have to be, where gravity and your speed would be the same, and
look
the person on the surface would have clocks running at the same rate as the person.
Okay, so
in
you're
orbit.
Not at 2,000 miles.
Okay,
so.
Well, you know, I think most of us should be 2,000 miles high to figure out this show, but we're done. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. We'll see you next month. Support comes from Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, resume and cover letter writing, accepting new clients, Careers in Transition, LLC.com. And the Hyde Collection in Glens Falls. Live cinema events with Met Live, National Theater Live, and great art on screen. HydeCollection.org to learn more. Hey, once again, don't forget, we have a show coming up. It is a special. It is a debate, a candidate forum in the race for the New York State Assembly's 109th district seat, being hosted by WAMC and the New York League of Conservation Voters Education Fund. We will be carrying that for you in a moment. Thanks to Bob. Thanks to Valerie. Thanks to Zach. Thanks to Susie Chekai. Thanks to you. Tomorrow it's Food Friday. Bruce and Mark will be back to talk about food and whatever else they want to. We'll see you too.